The Forever War, Disc 5.
We spent a lazy, comfortable 3 days crossing the Atlantic. The dirigibles had been a new thing when we first left Earth, and now they had turned out to be one of the few successful new financial ventures of the late 20th century. The company that built them had bought up a few obsolete nuclear weapons. One bomb-sized hunk of plutonium would keep the whole fleet in the air for years. And once launched, they never did come down. Floating hotels, supplied and maintained by regular shuttles, they were one last vestige of luxury in a world where 9 billion people had something to eat and almost nobody had enough. London was not as dismal from the air as New York City had been. The air was clean, even if the Thames was poison. We packed our handbags, claimed our weapons, and landed on a VTO pad atop the London Hilton. We rented a couple of tricycles at the hotel, and, maps in hand, set off for Regent Street, planning on dinner at the venerable Café Royal. The tricycles were little armored vehicles, stabilized gyroscopically so they couldn't be tipped over. Seemed overly cautious for the part of London we traveled through, but I suppose there were probably sections as rough as Washington. I got a dish of marinated venison, and Mary Gay got salmon, both very good, but astoundingly expensive. At first I was a bit overawed by the huge room, filled with plush and mirrors and faded gilding, very quiet, even with a dozen tables occupied. And we talked in whispers, until we realized that was foolish. Over coffee, I asked Mary Gay what the deal was with her parents. "Oh, it happens often enough," she said. "Dad got mixed up in some ration ticket thing. He'd gotten some black market tickets that turned out to be counterfeit. Cost him his job, and he probably would have gone to jail. But while he was waiting for trial, a body snatcher got him."
"Body snatcher?"
"That's right. All the commune organizations have them. They've got to get reliable farm labor, people who aren't eligible for relief, people who can't just lay down their tools and walk off when it gets rough. Almost everybody can get enough assistance to stay alive, though, everyone who isn't on the government's fecal roster."
"So he skipped out before his trial came up?"
She nodded.
"It was a case of choosing between commune life, which he knew wasn't easy, and going on the dole after a few years working on a prison farm. Ex-convicts can't get legitimate jobs. They had to forfeit their condominium, which they'd put up for bail, but the government would have gotten that anyhow once he was in jail. So the body snatcher offered him and mother new identities, transportation to the commune, a cottage, and a plot of land. They took it."
"And what did the body snatcher get?"
"He himself probably didn't get anything. The commune got their ration tickets. They were allowed to keep their money, although they didn't have very much."
"What happens if they get caught?"
"Not a chance," she laughed. "The communes provide over half the country's produce. They're really just an unofficial arm of the government. I'm sure the CBI knows exactly where they are. Dad grumbles that it's just a fancy way of being in jail anyhow."
"What a weird setup."
"Well, it keeps the land farmed."
She pushed her empty dessert plate a symbolic centimeter away from her.
"And they're eating better than most people, better than they ever had in the city. Mom knows 100 ways to fix chicken and potatoes."
After dinner, we went to a musical show. The hotel had gotten us tickets to a cultural translation of the old rock opera Hair. The program explained that they had taken some liberties with the original choreography, because back in those days, they didn't allow actual coition on stage. The music was pleasantly old-fashioned, but neither of us was quite old enough to work up any blurry-eyed nostalgia over it. Still, it was much more enjoyable than the movies I'd seen, and some of the physical feats performed were quite inspiring. We slept late the next morning.
We dutifully watched the changing of the guard at Buckingham Palace, walked through the British Museum, ate fish and chips, ran up to Stratford-on-Avon and caught the Old Vic doing an incomprehensible play about a mad king, and didn't get into any trouble until the day before we were to leave for Lisbon. It was about 2 a.m., and we were tooling our tricycles down a nearly deserted thoroughfare. Turned a corner, and there was a gang of boys beating the hell out of someone. I screeched to the curb and leaped out of my vehicle, firing the shotgun pistol over their heads. It was a girl they were attacking. It was rape. Most of them scattered, but one pulled a pistol out of his coat, and I shot him. I remember trying to aim for his arm. The blast hit his shoulder and ripped off his arm and what seemed to be half of his chest. It flung him 2 meters to the side of a building, and he must have been dead before he hit the ground. The others ran, one of them shooting at me with a little pistol as he went. I watched him trying to kill me for the longest time before it occurred to me to shoot back. I sent one blast way high, and he dove into an alley and disappeared. The girl looked dazedly around, saw the mutilated body of her attacker, and staggered to her feet and ran off screaming, naked from the waist down. I knew I should have tried to stop her, but I couldn't find my voice, and my feet seemed nailed to the sidewalk. A tricycle door slammed, and Mary Gay was beside me.
"What happened?"
she gasped, seeing the dead man.
What was he doing?"
I just stood there, stupefied. I'd certainly seen enough death these past 2 years, but this was a different thing. There was nothing noble in being crushed to death by the failure of some electronic component, or in having your suit fail and freeze you solid, or even dying in a shootout with the incomprehensible enemy. But death seemed natural in that setting. Not on a quaint little street in old-fashioned London. Not for trying to steal what most people would give freely. Mary Gay was pulling my arm.
"We've got to get out of here. They'll brainwipe you."
She was right. I turned and took one step and fell to the concrete. I looked down at the leg that had betrayed me, and bright red blood was pulsing out of a small hole in my calf. Mary Gay tore a strip of cloth from her blouse and started to bind it. I remember thinking it wasn't a big enough wound to go into shock over, but my ears started to ring, and I got lightheaded, and everything went red and fuzzy. Before I went under, I heard a siren wailing in the distance. Fortunately, the police also picked up the girl, who was wandering down the street a few blocks away. They compared her version of the thing with mine, both of us under hypnosis. They let me go with a stern admonition to leave law enforcement up to professional law enforcers. I wanted to get out of the cities, just put a pack on my back and wander through the woods for a while, get my mind straightened out. So did Mary Gay. But we tried to make arrangements and found that the country was worse than the cities. Farms were practically armed camps, the areas between ruled by nomad gangs who survived by making lightning raids into villages and farms, murdering and plundering for a few minutes, and then fading back into the forest before help could arrive. Still, Britishers called their island the most civilized country in Europe. From what we'd heard about France and Spain and Germany, especially Germany, they were probably right. I talked it over with Mary Gay, and we decided to cut short our tour and go back to the States. We could finish the tour after we'd become acclimated to the 21st century. It was just too much foreignness to take in one dose. The dirigible line refunded most of our money, and we took a conventional suborbital flight back home. The high altitude made my leg throb, though it was nearly healed. They'd made great strides in the treatment of gunshot wounds in the past 20 years. Lots of practice. We split up at Ellis. Her description of commune life appealed to me more than the city. I made arrangements to join her after a week or so, and went back to Washington.
Chapter 10. I rang the bell, and a strange woman answered the door, opening it a couple of centimeters and peering through. "Pardon me," I said. "Isn't this Mrs. Mandela's residence?"
"Oh, you must be William."
She closed the door and unfastened the chains and opened it wide.
"Beth, look who's here."
My mother came into the living room from the kitchen, drying her hands on a towel.
"Willie, what are you doing back so soon?"
"Well, it's a long story."
"Sit down, sit down," the other woman said. "Let me get you a drink. Don't start till I get back."
"Wait," my mother said.
"I haven't even introduced you to. William, this is Rhonda Wilder. Rhonda, William." "I've been so looking forward to meeting you," she said. "Beth has told me all about you. One cold beer, right?"
"Right." She was likable enough, a trim middle-aged woman. I wondered why I hadn't met her before. I asked my mother whether she was a neighbor.
Really more than that, William. She's been my roommate for a couple of years. That's why I had an extra room when you came home. A single person isn't allowed two bedrooms."
"But why?"
"I didn't tell you because I didn't want you to feel that you were putting her out of her room while you stayed here. And you weren't, actually. She has..."
"That's right."
Rhonda came in with the beer.
"I've got relatives in Pennsylvania out in the country. I can stay with them any time."
"Thanks." I took the beer. "Actually, I won't be here long. I'm kind of en route to South Dakota. I could find another place to flop."
"Oh, no," Rhonda said. "I can take the couch."
I was too old-fashioned male chauve to allow that. We discussed it for a minute, and I wound up with the couch. I filled Rhonda in on who Mary Gay was and told them about our disturbing experiences in England, how we came back to get our bearings. I had expected my mother to be horrified that I had killed a man, but she accepted it without comment. Rhonda clucked a little bit about our being out in a city after midnight, especially without a bodyguard. We talked on these and other topics until late at night, when Mother called her bodyguard and went off to work. Something had been nagging at me all night, the way Mother and Rhonda acted toward each other. I decided to bring it out into the open once Mother was gone. "Rhonda," I settled down in the chair across from her. I didn't know exactly how to put it. What exactly is your relationship with my mother?" She took a long drink.
"Good friends."
She stared at me with a mixture of defiance and resignation.
"Very good friends. Sometimes lovers."
I felt very hollow and lost. My mother?
"Listen," she continued. "You had better stop trying to live in the 90s. This may not be the best of all possible worlds, but you're stuck with it."
She crossed and took my hand, almost kneeling in front of me. Her voice was softer.
"William, look, I'm only 2 years older than you are. That is, I was born 2 years before. What I mean is, I can understand how you feel. Your mother understands, too. Our relationship wouldn't be a secret to anybody else. It's perfectly normal. A lot has changed these 20 years. You've got to change, too."
I didn't say anything. She stood up and said firmly,
"You think because your mother is 60 she's outgrown her need for love? She needs it more than you do, even now, especially now."
Accusation in her eyes.
"Especially now with you coming back from the dead past, reminding her of how old she is, how old I am, 20 years younger."
Her voice quavered and cracked, and she ran to her room. I wrote Mother a note saying that Mary Gay had called, an emergency had come up, and I had to go immediately to South Dakota. I called a bodyguard and left. A whining, ozone-leaking, battered old bus let me out at the intersection of a bad road and a worse one. It had taken me an hour to go the 2,000 kilometers to Sioux Falls, 2 hours to get a chopper to Geddes, 150 kilometers away, and 3 hours waiting and jouncing on the dilapidated bus to go the last 12 kilometers to Freehold, an organization of communes where the Potters had their acreage. I wondered if the progression was going to continue, and I would be 4 hours walking down this dirt road to the farm. It was a half hour before I even came to a building. My bag was getting intolerably heavy, and the bulky pistol was chafing my hip. I walked up a stone path to the door of a simple plastic dome and pulled a string that caused a bell to tinkle inside. A peephole darkened. "Who is it?" Voice muffled by thick wood. "Stranger, asking directions." "Ask." I couldn't tell whether it was a woman or a child. "I'm looking for the Potter's farm." "Just a second." Footsteps went away and came back. "Down the road 1.9 clicks, lots of potatoes and green beans on your right. You probably smell the chickens." "Thanks." "If you want a drink, we got a pump out back. Can't let you in without my husband's at home." "I understand. Thank you." The water was metallic-tasting, but wonderfully cool. I wouldn't know a potato or green bean plant if it stood up and took a bite out of my ankle, but I knew how to walk a half-meter step, so I resolved to count to 3,800 and take a deep breath. I supposed I could tell the difference between the smell of chicken manure and the absence thereof. At 3650, there was a rutted path leading to a complex of plastic domes and rectangular buildings, apparently made of sod. There was a pen enclosing a small population explosion of chickens. They had a smell, but it wasn't strong. Halfway down the path, a door opened, and Mary Gay came running out, wearing one tiny wisp of cloth. After a slippery but gratifying greeting, she asked what I was doing here so early. Oh, my mother had friends staying with her. I didn't want to put them out. Suppose I should have called.
Indeed, you should have. Save you a long, dusty walk. But we've got plenty of room. Don't worry about that.
She took me inside to meet her parents, who greeted me warmly, and made me feel definitely overdressed. Their faces showed their age, but their bodies had no sag and few wrinkles. Since dinner was an occasion, they let the chickens live, and instead opened a can of beef, steaming it along with a cabbage and some potatoes. To my plain tastes, it was equal to most of the gourmet fare we'd had on the dirigible and in London. Over coffee and goat cheese, they apologized for not having wine. The commune would have a new vintage out in a couple of weeks. I asked what kind of work I could do.
"Will," Mr. Potter said, "I don't mind telling you that your coming here is a godsend. We've got 5 acres that are just sitting out there, fallow, because we don't have enough hands to work them. You can take the plow tomorrow and start breaking up an acre at a time."
"More potatoes, Daddy?" Mary Gay asked.
"No, no, not this season. Soybeans. Cash crop and good for the soil. And Will, at night we all take turns standing guard. With 4 of us, we ought to be able to do a lot more sleeping."
He took a big slurp of coffee.
"Now, what else?"
"Richard,"
Mrs. Potter said, "tell him about the greenhouse." "That's right, yes, the greenhouse. The commune has a 2-acre greenhouse down about a click from here, by the recreation center, mostly grapes and tomatoes. Everybody spends one morning or one afternoon a week there. Why don't you children go down there tonight, show Will the nightlife in fabulous Freehold?
Sometimes you can get a real exciting game of checkers going.
Oh, Daddy, it's not that bad.
Actually, it isn't. They've got a fair library and a coin-op terminal to the Library of Congress. Marigate tells me you're a reader. That's good.
Sounds fascinating.
It did.
But what about Guard?
No problem. Mrs. Potter, April, and I'll take the first 4 hours.
Oh, he said, standing.
Let me show you the setup.
We went out back to the tower, a sandbag hut on stilts, climbed up a rope ladder through a hole in the middle of the hut.
A little crowded in here with two, Richard said. Have a seat.
There was an old piano stool beside the hole in the floor. I sat on it.
It's handy to be able to see all the field without getting a crick in your neck. Just don't keep turning in the same direction all the time.
He opened a wooden crate and uncovered a sleek rifle wrapped in oily rags.
Recognize this?
Sure. I'd had to sleep with one in basic training.
Army Standard Issue T-16, semi-automatic 12-caliber tumblers.
Where the hell did you get it?
Commune went to a government auction. It's an antique now, son.
He handed it to me and I snapped it apart. Clean. Too clean.
Has it ever been used? Not in almost a year. Ammo costs too much for target practice. Take a couple of practice shots, though. Convince yourself that it works.
I turned on the scope and just got a washed-out bright green. Set for nighttime. Clicked it back to log zero, set the magnification at 10, reassembled it.
Mary Gay didn't want to try it out. Said she'd had her fill of that. I didn't press her, but a person's got to have confidence in their tools.
I clicked off the safety and found a clod of dirt that the rangefinder said was between 100 and 120 meters away. Set it at 110, rested the barrel of the rifle on the sandbags, centered the clod in the crosshairs, and squeezed. The round hissed out and kicked up dirt about 5 centimeters low.
Fine. I reset it for night use and safetied it and handed it back.
What happened a year ago?
He wrapped it up carefully, keeping the rags away from the eyepiece. Had some jumpers come in, fired a few rounds and scared him away.
All right, what's a jumper?
Yeah, you wouldn't know.
He shook out a tobacco cigarette and passed me the box.
I don't know why they don't just call them thieves. That's what they are. Murderers, too, sometimes. They know that a lot of the commune members are pretty well off. If you raise cash crops, you get to keep half the cash. Besides, a lot of our members were prosperous when they joined. Anyhow, the jumpers take advantage of our relative isolation. They come out from the city and try to sneak in, usually hit one place and run. Most of the time they don't get this far in, but the farm's closer to the road. We hear gunfire every couple of weeks, usually just scaring off kids. If it keeps up, a siren goes off, and the commune goes on alert.
Doesn't sound fair to the people living close to the road.
There are compensations. They only have to donate half as much of their crop as the rest of us do, and they're issued heavier weapons.
Mary Gay and I took the family's 2 bicycles and pedaled down to the recreation center. I only fell off twice, negotiating the bumpy road in the dark. It was a little livelier than Richard had described it. A young nude girl was dancing sensuously to an assortment of homemade drums near the far side of the dome. Turned out she was still in school. It was a project for a cultural relativity class. Most of the people there, in fact, were young and therefore still in school. They considered it a joke, though. After you had learned to read and write and could pass the Class 1 literacy test, you only had to take 1 course per year, and some of those you could pass just by signing up. So much for the 18 years compulsory education
they had startled us with at Stargate. Other people were playing board games, reading, watching the girl gyrate, or just talking. There was a bar that served soya, coffee, or thin homemade beer. Not a ration ticket to be seen. All made by the commune or purchased outside with commune tickets. We got into a discussion about the war with a bunch of people who knew Mary Gay and I were veterans. It's hard to describe their attitude, which was pretty uniform. They were angry in an abstract way that it took so much tax money to support. They were convinced that the Torrens would never be any danger to Earth, but they all knew that nearly half the jobs in the world were associated with the war, and if it stopped, everything would fall apart. I thought everything was in shambles already, but then I hadn't grown up in this world, and they had never known peacetime. We went home about midnight, and Mary Gay and I each stood 2 hours guard. By the middle of the next morning, I was wishing I'd gotten a little more sleep. The plow was a big blade on wheels with two handles for steering, atomic-powered. Not very much power, though, enough to move it forward at a slow crawl if the blade was in soft earth. Needless to say, there was little soft earth in the unused 5 acres. The plow would go a few centimeters, get stuck, freewheel until I put some back into it, then move a few more centimeters. I finished a tenth of an acre the first day, and eventually got it up to a fifth of an acre a day. It was hard, hardening work, but pleasant. I had an ear clip that piped music to me, old tapes from Richard's collection, and the sun browned me all over. I was beginning to think I could live that way forever. Mary Gay and I were reading up at the recreation center one evening when we heard faint gunfire down by the road. We decided it'd be smart to get back to the house. We were less than halfway there when firing broke out all along our left, on a line that seemed to extend from the road to far past the recreation center. A coordinated attack. We had to abandon the bikes and crawl on hands and knees in the drainage ditch by the side of the road, bullets hissing over our heads. A heavy vehicle rumbled by, shooting left and right. It took a good 20 minutes to crawl home. We passed 2 farmhouses that were burning brightly. I was glad ours didn't have any wood. I noticed there was no return fire coming from our tower, but didn't say anything. There were 2 dead strangers in front of the house as we rushed inside. April was lying on the floor, still alive, but bleeding from 100 tiny fragment wounds. The living room was rubble and dust. Someone must have thrown a bomb through a door or window. I left Mary Gay with her mother and ran out back to the tower. The ladder was pulled up, so I had to shinny up one of the stilts. Richard was sitting slumped over the rifle. In the pale green glow from the scope, I could see a perfectly round hole above his left eye. A little blood had trickled down the bridge of his nose and dried. I laid his body on the floor and covered his head with my shirt. I filled my pockets with clips and took the rifle back to the house. Mary Gay had tried to make her mother comfortable. They were talking quietly. She was holding my shotgun pistol and had another gun on the floor beside her. When I came in, she looked up and nodded soberly, not crying. April whispered something, and Mary Gay asked, "Mother wants to know whether Daddy had a hard time of it. She knows he's dead." "No, I'm sure he didn't feel anything." "That's good." "It's something. I should keep my mouth shut." "It is good, yes." I checked the doors and windows for an effective vantage point. I couldn't find any place that wouldn't allow a whole platoon to sneak up behind me. "I'm going to go outside and get on top of the house." Couldn't go back to the tower. "Don't you shoot unless somebody gets inside. Maybe they'll think the place is deserted." By the time I had clambered up to the sod roof, the heavy truck was coming back down the road. Through the scope, I could see that there were 5 men on it, 4 in the cab and 1 who was on the open bed, cradling a machine gun, surrounded by loot. He was crouched between two refrigerators, but I had a clear shot at him. Held my fire, not wanting to draw attention. The truck stopped in front of the house, sat for a minute, and turned in. The window was probably bulletproof, but I sighted on the driver's face and squeezed off around. He jumped as it ricocheted, whining, leaving an opaque star on the plastic, and the man in back opened up. A steady stream of bullets hummed over my head. I could hear them thumping into the sandbags of the tower. He didn't see me. The truck wasn't 10 meters away when the shooting stopped. He was evidently reloading, hidden behind the refrigerator. I took careful aim, and when he popped up to fire, I shot him in the throat. The bullet being a tumbler, it exited through the top of his skull. The driver pulled the truck around in a long arc so that when it stopped, the door to the cab was flush with the door of the house. This protected them from the tower and also from me, though I doubted they yet knew where I was. A T-16 makes no flash and very little noise. I kicked off my shoes and stepped cautiously onto the top of the cab, hoping the driver would get out on his side. Once the door opened, I could fill the cab with ricocheting bullets. No good. The far door, hidden from me by the roof's overhang, opened first. I waited for the driver and hoped that Mary Gay was well hidden. I shouldn't have worried. There was a deafening roar, then another and another. The heavy truck rocked with the impact of thousands of tiny flechettes. One short scream that the second shot ended. I jumped from the truck and ran around to the back door. Mary Gay had her mother's head on her lap, and someone was crying softly. I went to them, and Mary Gay's cheeks were dry under my palms. "Good work, dear." She didn't say anything. There was a steady, heavy dripping sound from the door, and the air was acrid with smoke and the smell of fresh meat. We huddled together until dawn. I had thought April was sleeping, but in the dim light her eyes were wide open and filmed. Her breath came in shallow rasps. Her skin was gray parchment and dried blood. She didn't answer when we talked to her. A vehicle was coming up the road, so I took the rifle and went outside. It was a dump truck with a white sheet draped over one side, and a man standing in the back with a megaphone repeating, "Wounded! Wounded!" I waved, and the truck came in. They took April out on a makeshift litter and told us which hospital they were going to. We wanted to go along, but there was simply no room. The bed of the truck was covered with people in various stages of disrepair. Mary Gay didn't want to go back inside because it was getting light enough to see the men she had killed so completely. I went back in to get some cigarettes and forced myself to look. It was messy enough, but just didn't disturb me that much. That bothered me, to be confronted with a pile of human hamburger and mainly notice the flies and ants and smell. Death is so much neater in space. We buried her father behind the house, and when the truck came back with April's small body wrapped in a shroud, we buried her beside him. The commune sanitation truck came by a little later, and gas-masked men took care of the jumpers' bodies. We sat in the baking sun, and finally Mary Gay wept for a long time, silently. Chapter 11. We got off the plane at Dulles and found a monorail to Columbia. It was a pleasingly diverse jumble of various kinds of buildings arranged around a lake, surrounded by trees. All of the buildings were connected by slidewalk to the largest place, a Fuller Dome with stores and schools and offices. We could have taken the enclosed slidewalk to Mom's place, but instead walked alongside it in the good, cold air that smelled of fallen leaves. People slid by on the other side of the plastic, carefully, not staring. Mom didn't answer her door, but she'd given me an entry card. Mom was asleep in the bedroom, so Mary Gay and I settled in the living room and read for a while. We were startled suddenly by a loud fit of coughing from the bedroom. I raced over and knocked on the door.
William? I didn't...
Coughing.
Come in. I didn't know you were...
She was propped up in bed, the light on, surrounded by various nostrums. She looked ghastly, pale and lined. She lit a joint, and it seemed to quell the coughing.
When did you get in? I didn't know.
Just a few minutes ago. How long is this? Have you been...
Oh, it's just a bug I picked up after Rhonda went to see her kids. I'll be fine in a couple of days.
She started coughing again, drank some thick red liquid from a bottle. All of her medicine seemed to be the commercial patent variety. Have you seen a doctor?
Doctor? Heavens no, Willie. They don't have... It's not serious. Don't...
Not serious? At 84. For Christ's sake, Mother. I went to the phone in the kitchen and with some difficulty managed to get the hospital. A plain girl in her 20s formed in the cube.
Nurse Donaldson, General Services. She had a fixed smile, professional sincerity. But then everybody smiled. My mother needs to be looked at by a doctor. She has a...
Name and number, please?
Beth Mandela, I spelled it.
What number?
Medical services number, of course, she smiled. I called into Mom and asked her what her number was. She says she can't remember.
That's all right, sir. I'm sure I can find her records.
She turned her smile to a keyboard beside her and punched out a code.
Beth Mandela?
She said, her smile turning quizzical.
You're her son? She must be in her 80s.
Please, it's a long story. She really has to see a doctor.
Is this some kind of joke?
What do you mean? Strangled coughing from the other room, the worst yet. Really, this might be very serious. You've got to...
But, sir, Mrs. Mandela got a zero priority rating way back in 2010.
What the hell is that supposed to mean?
Sir?
The smile was hardening in place. Look, pretend that I came from another planet. What is a zero priority rating?
Another...
Oh, I know you. She looked off to the left.
Sonia, come over here a second. You'd never guess who...
Another face crowded the cube. A vapid blonde girl whose smile was twin to the other nurse's.
Remember on the stat this morning?
Oh, yeah, she said. One of the soldiers. Hey, that's really Max, really Max.
The head withdrew.
Oh, Mr. Mandela, she said, effusive. No wonder you're confused. It's really very simple.
Well...
It's part of the Universal Medical Security System. Everybody gets a rating on their 70th birthday. It comes in automatically from Geneva.
What does it rate? What does it mean? But the ugly truth was obvious.
Well, it tells how important a person is and what level of treatment he's allowed. Class 3 is the same as anybody else's. Class 2 is the same, except for certain life-extending...
And Class 0 is no treatment at all.
That's correct, Mr. Mandela.
And in her smile was not a glimmer of pity or understanding. Thank you. I disconnected. Mary Gay was standing behind me, crying soundlessly, with her mouth wide open. I found Mountaineer's oxygen at a sporting goods store, and even managed to get some black market antibiotics through a character in a bar downtown in Washington. But Mom was beyond being able to respond to amateur treatment. She lived 4 days.
The people from the crematorium had the same fixed smile. I tried to get through to my brother, Mike, on the moon, but the phone company wouldn't let me place the call until I had signed a contract and posted a $25,000 bond. I had to get a credit transfer from Geneva. The paperwork took half a day. I finally got through to him. Without preamble. Mother's dead. For a fraction of a second, the radio waves wandered up to the moon, and in another fraction came back. He started, and then nodded his head slowly. No surprise. Every time I've come down to Earth the past 10 years, I've wondered whether she'd still be there. Neither of us had enough money to keep in very close touch. He had told us in Geneva that a letter from Luna to Earth cost $100 postage, plus $5,000 tax. It discouraged communication with what the UN considered to be a bunch of regrettably necessary anarchists. We commiserated for a while, and then Mike said, "Willie, Earth is no place for you and Mary Gay. You know that by now. Come to Luna, where you can still be an individual, where we don't throw people out the airlock on their 70th birthday." "We'd have to rejoin UNIF." "True, but you wouldn't have to fight. They say they need you more for training. You could study in your spare time, bring your physics up to date, maybe wind up eventually in research." We talked some more, a total of 3 minutes. I got $1,000 back. Mary Gay and I talked about it through the night. Maybe our decision would have been different if we hadn't been staying there, surrounded by Mother's life and death. But when the dawn came, the proud, ambitious, careful beauty of Columbia had turned sinister and foreboding. We packed our bags and had our money transferred to the Tyco Credit Union and took a monorail to the Cape. "In case you're interested, you aren't the first combat veterans to come back." The recruiting officer was a muscular lieutenant of indeterminate sex. I flipped a coin mentally, and it came up tails.
"Last I heard, there had been 9 others, she said in her husky tenor. "All of them opted for the moon. Maybe you'll find some of your friends there." She slid 2 simple forms across the desk. "Sign these and you're in again. Second lieutenants." The form was a simple request to be assigned to active duty. We had never really gotten out of the force, since they extended the draft law, but had just been on inactive status. I scrutinized the paper. "There's nothing on this about the guarantees we were given at Stargate." "That won't be necessary. The force will..." "I think it is necessary, Lieutenant." I handed back the form, so did Mary Gay. "Let me check." She left the desk and disappeared into an office. After a while, we heard a printer rattle. She brought back the same 2 sheets with an addition typed under our names. Guaranteed location of choice, Luna, and assignment of choice, combat training specialist. We got a thorough physical checkup and were fitted for new fighting suits, made our financial arrangements, and caught the next morning shuttle. We laid over at Earthport, enjoying zero gravity for a few hours, and then caught a ride to Luna, setting down at the Grimaldi base. On the door to the transient officer's billet, some wag had scraped, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter." We found our 2-man cubicle and began changing for chow. 2 raps on the door. "Mail call, sirs." I opened the door, and the sergeant standing there saluted. I just looked at him for a second, and then remembered I was an officer, and returned the salute. He handed me 2 identical faxes. I gave 1 to Mary Gay, and we both gasped at the same time. Orders. The following named personnel: Mandela William, 2nd Lieutenant, 11575278, COCOM, D Company, Grimaldi Training Battalion, and
Potter, Mary Gay, 2nd Lieutenant, 17386907, COCOM B Company, Grimaldi Training Battalion, are hereby reassigned to Lieutenant Mandela, PLCOM 2nd Platoon, STF Theta Stargate, Lieutenant Potter, PLCOM 3rd Platoon, STF Theta Stargate. Description of duties: Command Infantry Platoon in Tet 2 Campaign. The above-named personnel will report immediately to Grimaldi Transportation Battalion to be manifested to Stargate. Issued, Stargate, TAC BD/12988684-1450/20 August 2019. Signed by Otho, STFCOM Commander.
They didn't waste any time, did they? Mary Gay said bitterly.
Must be a standing order. Strike Force Command's light weeks away. They can't even know we've re-upped yet.
What about our...
She let it trail off. The guarantee. Well, we were given our assignment of choice. Nobody guaranteed we'd have the assignment for more than an hour.
It's so dirty.
I shrugged. It's so Army. But I couldn't shake the feeling that we were going home.
Lieutenant Mandela, 2024 to 2389 AD.
Quick and dirty. I was looking at my platoon sergeant, Santesteban, but talking to myself and anybody else who was listening.
Yeah, he said. Gotta do it in the first couple of minutes or we're screwed tight. He was, matter of fact, laconic. Drugged. Private Collins came up with Halliday. They were holding hands, unself-consciously.
Lieutenant Mandela?
Her voice broke a little.
Can we have just a minute?
1 minute, I said too abruptly. We have to leave in 5. I'm sorry. Hard to watch those two together now. Neither one had any combat experience, but they knew what everybody did. How slim their chances were of ever being together again. They slumped in a corner and mumbled words and traded mechanical caresses. No passion or even comfort. Collins's eyes shone, but she wasn't weeping. Halliday just looked grim, numb. She was normally by far the prettier of the two, but the sparkle had gone out of her and left a well-formed, dull shell. I'd gotten used to open female homo sex in the months since we'd left Earth, even stopped resenting the loss of potential partners. The men, together, still gave me a chill, though. I stripped and backed into the clam-shelled suit. The new ones were a hell of a lot more complicated, with all the new biometrics and trauma maintenance, but well worth the trouble of hooking up, in case you got blown apart just a little bit. Go home to a comfortable pension with heroic prosthesis. They were even talking about the possibility of regeneration, at least for missing arms and legs. Better get it soon before heaven filled up with fractional people. Heaven was the new hospital rest and recreation planet. I finished the setup sequence and the suit closed by itself, gritted my teeth against the pain that never came when the internal sensors and fluid tubes poked into your body, conditioned neural bypass, so you felt only a slight puzzling dislocation rather than the death of a thousand cuts. Collins and Halliday were getting into their suits now, and the other dozen were almost set, so I stepped over to the 3rd Platoon's staging area. Say goodbye again to Mary Gay. She was suited and heading my way. We touched helmets instead of using the radio. Privacy. Feeling okay, honey?
All right, she said. Took my pill.
Yeah, happy times. I'd taken mine, too. Supposed to make you feel optimistic without interfering with your sense of judgment.
I knew most of us would probably die, but I didn't feel too bad about it. Sack with me tonight?
If we're both here, she said neutrally. Have to take a pill for that, too.
She tried to laugh.
Sleep, I mean. How are the new people taking it? You have 10?
10, yeah, they're okay. Doped up, quarter dose.
I did that, too. Try to keep them loose.
In fact, Santesteban was the only other combat veteran in my platoon. The four corporals had been in UNEF for a while, but hadn't ever fought. The speaker in my cheekbone crackled, and Commander Cortez said,
2 minutes. Get your people lined up.
We had our goodbye, and I went back to check my flock. Everybody seemed to have gotten suited up without any problem, so I put them online. We waited for what seemed like a long time.
All right, load them up.
With the word up, the bay door in front of me opened, the staging area having already been bled of air, and I led my men and women through to the assault ship. These new ships were ugly as hell. Just an open framework with clamps to hold you in place, swiveled lasers fore and aft, small tachyon power plants below the lasers. Everything automated. The machine would land us as quickly as possible and then zip off to harass the enemy. It was a one-use, throwaway drone. The vehicle that would come pick us up if we survived was cradled next to it, much prettier. We clamped in, and the assault ship cast off from the Sangre y Victoria, with twin spurts from the yaw jets. Then the voice of the machine gave us a short countdown, and we sped off at 4 G's acceleration, straight down. The planet, which we hadn't bothered to name, was a chunk of black rock without any normal star close enough to give it heat. At first it was visible only by the absence of stars, where its bulk cut off their light. But as we dropped closer, we could see subtle variations in the blackness of its surface. We were coming down on the hemisphere opposite the Torrens outpost. Our recon had shown that their camp sat in the middle of a flat lava plain several hundred kilometers in diameter. It was pretty primitive compared to other Torren bases UNEF had encountered, but there wouldn't be any sneaking up on it. We were going to careen over the horizon some 15 clicks from the place. 4 ships, converging simultaneously from different directions, all of us decelerating like mad, hopefully to drop right in their laps and come up shooting. There would be nothing to hide behind. I wasn't worried, of course. Abstractedly, I wished I hadn't taken the pill. We leveled off about a kilometer from the surface and sped along much faster than the rock's escape velocity, constantly correcting to keep from flying away. The surface rolled below us in a dark gray blur. We shed a little light from the pseudo-Serenkov glow made by our tachyon exhaust, scooting away from our reality into its own. The ungainly contraption skimmed and jumped along for some 10 minutes, then suddenly the front jet glowed, and we were snapped forward inside our suits, eyeballs trying to escape from their sockets in the rapid deceleration.
"Prepare for ejection,"
the machine's female mechanical voice said.
5, 4...
The ship's lasers started firing, millisecond flashes freezing the land below in jerky stroboscopic motion. It was a twisted, pockmarked jumble of fissures and random black rocks a few meters below our feet. We were dropping, slowing.
3.
It never got any farther. There was a too bright flash, and I saw the horizon drop away as the ship's tail pitched down, then clipped the ground, and we were rolling, horribly, pieces of people and ship scattering. Then we slid, pinwheeling, to a bumpy halt, and I tried to pull free, but my leg was pinned under the ship's bulk. Excruciating pain and a dry crunch as the girder crushed my leg.
shrill whistle of air escaping my breached suit. Then the trauma maintenance turned on. Snick. More pain. Then no pain, and I was rolling free. Short stump of a leg trailing blood that froze shiny black on the dull black rock. I tasted brass, and a red haze closed everything out, then deepened to the brown of river clay, then loam, and I passed out, with the pill, thinking, this is not so bad. The suit is set up to save as much of your body as possible. If you lose part of an arm or leg, one of 16 razor-sharp irises closes around your limb with the force of a hydraulic press, snipping it off neatly and sealing the suit before you can die of explosive decompression. Then trauma maintenance cauterizes the stump, replaces lost blood, and fills you full of happy juice and no shock. So you will either die happy or, if your comrades go on to win the battle, eventually be carried back up to the ship's aid station. We'd won that round, while I slept, swaddled in dark cotton. I woke up in the infirmary. It was crowded. I was in the middle of a long row of cots, each one holding someone who had been 3/4 or less saved by his suit's trauma maintenance feature. We were being ignored by the ship's two doctors, who stood in bright light at operating tables, absorbed in blood rituals. I watched them for a long time, squinting into the bright light. The blood on their green tunics could have been grease. The swathed bodies, odd, soft machines that they were fixing. But the machines would cry out in their sleep, and the mechanics muttered reassurances while they plied their greasy tools. I watched, and slept, and woke up in different places. Finally, I woke up in a regular bay. I was strapped down and being fed through a tube, biosensor electrodes attached here and there, but no medics around. The only other person in the little room was Mary Gay, sleeping on the bunk next to me. Her right arm was amputated, just above the elbow. I didn't wake her up, just looked at her for a long time, and tried to sort out my feelings. Tried to filter out the effect of the mood drugs. Looking at her stump, I could feel neither empathy nor revulsion. I tried to force one reaction and then the other, but nothing real happened. It was as if she had always been that way. Was it drugs? Conditioning? Love? Have to wait to see. Her eyes opened suddenly, and I knew she had been awake for some time, had been giving me time to think. "Hello, broken toy," she said. How do you feel?" Bright question. She put a finger to her lips and kissed it, a familiar gesture, reflection. "Stupid, numb, glad not to be a soldier anymore." She smiled. "Did they tell you? We're going to heaven." "No, I knew it would be either there or earth." "Heaven will be better."
"Anything would." "I wish we were there now."
"How long?" I asked. "How long before we get there?" She rolled over and looked at the ceiling.
"No telling. You haven't talked to anybody?"
"Just woke up."
"There's a new directive they didn't bother to tell us about before. The Sangre y Victoria got orders for 4 missions. We have to keep on fighting until we've done all 4, or until we've sustained so many casualties that it wouldn't be practical to go on."
"How many is that?"
"I wonder. We lost a good 1/3 already, but we're headed for Aleph 7, panty raid."
New slang term for the type of operation whose main object was to gather Torin artifacts and prisoners, if possible. I tried to find out where the term came from, but the one explanation I got was really idiotic. One knock on the door,
and Dr. Foster barged in. He fluttered his hands.
"Still in separate beds?
Mary Gay, I thought you were more recovered than that." Foster was all right, a flaming Mariposa, but he had an amused tolerance for heterosexuality. He examined Mary Gay's stump, and then mine. He stuck thermometers in our mouths so we couldn't talk. When he spoke, he was serious and blunt.
"I'm not going to sugarcoat anything for you. You're both on happy juice up to your ears, and the loss you've sustained isn't going to bother you until I take you off the stuff. For my own convenience, I'm keeping you drugged until you get to heaven. I have 21 amputees to take care of. We can't handle 21 psychiatric cases. Enjoy your peace of mind while you still have it. You two, especially since you'll probably want to stay together. The prosthetics you get on heaven will work just fine, but every time you look at this mechanical leg or you look at her arm, you're going to think of how lucky the other one is. You're going to constantly trigger memories of pain and loss for each other. You may be at each other's throats in a week, or you may share a sullen kind of love for the rest of your lives, or you may be able to transcend it. Give each other strength. Just don't kid yourselves if it doesn't work out." He checked the readout on each thermometer and made a notation in his notebook. "Doctor knows best, even if he is a little weird by your own old-fashioned standards. Keep it in mind." He took the thermometer out of my mouth and gave me a little pat on the shoulder. Impartially, he did the same to Mary Gay. At the door, he said, "We've got Collapsar insertion in about 6 hours. One of the nurses will take you to the tanks." We went into the tanks, so much more comfortable and safer than the old individual acceleration shells, and dropped into the TET-2 Collapsar field, already starting the crazy 50G evasive maneuvers that would protect us from enemy cruisers. When we popped out by Aleph 7, a microsecond later. Predictably, the Aleph 7 campaign was a dismal failure, and we limped away from it with a 2-campaign total of 54 dead and 39 cripples bound for heaven. Only 12 soldiers were still able to fight, but they weren't exactly straining at the leash. It took 3 Collapsar jumps to get to heaven. No ship ever went there directly from a battle, even though the delay sometimes cost extra lives. It was the one place, besides Earth, that the Torrens could not be allowed to find. Heaven was a lovely, unspoiled, Earth-like world. What Earth might have been like if men had treated her with compassion instead of lust. Virgin forests, white beaches, pristine deserts. The few dozen cities there either blended perfectly with the environment, one was totally underground, or were brazen statements of human ingenuity. Oceanus, in a coral reef with 6 fathoms of water over its transparent roof. Boreas, perched on a sheared-off mountaintop in the polar wasteland. And the fabulous sky, a huge resort city that floated from continent to continent on the trade winds. We landed, as everyone does, at the jungle city, Threshold. 3/4 hospital. It's by far the planet's largest city, but you couldn't tell that from the air, flying down from orbit. The only sign of civilization was a short runway that suddenly appeared, a small white patch dwarfed to insignificance by the stately rainforest that crowded in from the east and an immense ocean that dominated the other horizon. Once under the arboreal cover, the city was very much in evidence. Low buildings of native stone and wood rested among 10-meter-thick tree trunks. They were connected by unobtrusive stone paths, with one wide promenade meandering off to the beach. Sunlight filtered down in patches, and the air held a mixture of forest sweetness
and salt tang. I later learned that the city sprawled out over 200 square kilometers, that you could take a subway to any place that was too far to walk. The ecology of Threshold was very carefully balanced and maintained so as to resemble the jungle outside, with all the dangerous and uncomfortable elements eliminated. A powerful pressor field kept out large predators, and such insect life as was not necessary for the health of the plants inside. We walked, limped, and rolled into the nearest building, which was the hospital's reception area. The rest of the hospital was underneath, 30 subterranean stories. Each person was examined and assigned his own room. I tried to get a double with Mary Gay, but they weren't set up for that. Earth year was 2189. So I was 215 years old. God, look at that old codger. Somebody passed the hat. No, not necessary. The doctor who examined me said that my accumulated pay would be transferred from Earth to heaven. With compound interest, I was just shy of being a billionaire. He remarked that I'd find lots of ways to spend my billion on heaven. They took the most severely wounded first, so it was several days before I went into surgery. Afterwards, I woke up in my room and found that they had grafted a prosthesis onto my stump, an articulated structure of shiny metal that, to my untrained eye, looked exactly like the skeleton of a leg and foot. It looked creepy as hell, lying there in a transparent bag of fluid, wires running out of it to a machine at the end of the bed. An aide came in.
"How you feelin', sir?"
I almost told him to forget the sir bullshit. I was out of the army and staying out this time. But it might be nice for the guy to keep feeling that I outranked him. I don't know. Hurts a little.
Gonna hurt like a son of a bitch.
Wait till the nerves start to grow.
Nerves? Sure.
He was fiddling with a machine, reading dials on the other side.
How you gonna have a leg without nerves?
Get it just sit there.
Nerves? Like regular nerves?
You mean I can just think, move, and the thing moves?
Course you can.
He looked at me quizzically, then went back to his adjustments. What a wonder. Prosthetics has sure come a long way.
Pros what ix?
You know, artificial.
Oh, yeah. Like in books, wooden legs, hooks, and stuff.
How'd he ever get a job?
Yeah, prosthetics, like this thing on the end of my stump.
Look, sir. He set down the clipboard he'd been scribbling on.
You've been away a long time. That's gonna be a leg. Just like the other leg, except it can't break.
They do it with arms, too?
Sure, any limb.
He went back to his writing.
Livers, kidneys, stomachs, all kinds of things. Still working on hearts and lungs. Have to use mechanical substitutes.
Fantastic. Mary Gay would be whole again, too. He shrugged.
Guess so. They've been doing it since before I was born. How old are you, sir?
I told him, and he whistled.
God damn! You must have been in it from the beginning.
His accent was very strange. All the words were right, but all the sounds were wrong.
Yeah, I was in the Epsilon attack. Aleph Null.
They'd started naming collapsars after letters of the Hebrew alphabet, in order of discovery, then ran out of letters when the damn thing started cropping up all over the place. So they added numbers after the letters. Last I heard, they were up to Yod 42.
Wow! Ancient history. What was it like back then?
I don't know, less crowded, nicer.
Went back to Earth a year ago. Hell, a century ago. Depends on how you look at it. It was so bad I re-enlisted, you know. Bunch of zombies. No offense. He shrugged.
Never been there myself. People who come from there seem to miss it. Maybe it got better.
What, you were born on another planet? Heaven? No wonder I couldn't place his accent.
Born, raised, and drafted.
He put the pen back in his pocket and folded the clipboard up to a wallet-sized package.
Yes, sir, third generation angel. Best damned planet in all UNEF.
He spelled it out, didn't say UNIF, the way I'd always heard it.
Look, I've gotta run, Lieutenant. Two other monitors to check this hour.
He backed out the door.
You need anything? There's a buzzer on the table there.
Third generation angel. His grandparents came from Earth, probably when I was a young punk of 100. I wondered how many other worlds they'd colonized while my back was turned. Lose an arm, grow a new one. It was going to be good to settle down and live a whole year for every year that went by. The guy wasn't kidding about the pain. And it wasn't just the new leg, though that hurt like boiling oil. For the new tissues to take, they'd had to subvert my body's resistance to alien cells. Cancer broke out in a half dozen places and had to be treated separately, painfully.
This ends Disc 5.